Okay, Mr. Chair, the webinar is started and the recording and broadcasting is live.
Thank you. It's March 10th, and this is the board meeting of the Regional Water Quality Control Board of San Diego. To get started, I want to ask Roger Mitchell to please proceed with his opening statement.
Great. Thank you, Board Chair Cantu. Good morning. My name is Roger Mitchell. I am a supervising engineering geologist with the San Diego Water Board. Today, I'm serving as the remote meeting coordinator and would like to share some instructions on how to participate in today's virtual board meeting. If you wish to make a verbal comment during the public forum or during one of the board items, you must be signed into Zoom webinar or be participating by phone. If you are currently watching the webcast on calspan.org, and you want to comment on an agenda item, you'll need to register to sign into Zoom webinar or call into the meeting. Information on how to participate can be found on the San Diego Water Board's meeting agenda website. Public comments will be accepted for each item after all presentations for the item are complete. If you wish to speak on an item, please virtually raise your hand. If you are using a computer or tablet, please use the raise hand button in Zoom. If you are calling into Zoom, please dial *9 to raise your hand. Please use the raise hand feature to let the board know you wish to speak, even if you previously registered and indicated that you wish to speak on an item. If you do not raise your hand, we will assume you no longer wish to speak. When public comment starts on an item, the commenter order will be determined by the order each person raised their hand. I will call on each commenter by name, or if you are on a phone, I will call the last three digits of your phone number, and then I will unmute each person when it is their turn to speak. Please note, you will not appear by video during your testimony. There is a 3-minute time limit for each public commenter. However, that time could be extended at the chair's discretion. During public testimony, you will see a timer on the screen for those calling in by phone. We will run the timer and let you know when you have 30 seconds left and when your time is up. I would like to remind everyone participating in the board meeting today to state your name for the record before you speak, and please mute your microphone if you are not speaking. If you experience any technical difficulties, please call or text the area code 805-801-3676 or email it@agpvideo.com. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Will the clerk call the roll now?
Sorry, too many windows up at one time. Dr. Barbineau?
Here.
Mr. Anderson? I don't see him. Ms. Blair?
Present.
Dr. Olson?
Present.
Mr. Strawn?
Here.
Ms. Warren?
Here.
And Chair Cantu?
Present. We have a quorum. So I'll open the public forum. I understand we do have a presentation, a short presentation at the public forum for something that is not agendized or pending. So Mr. Mitchell, will you introduce our presenter of the public forum?
Yes, we have, I see Stephanie Gaines would like to speak.
Good morning. This is Stephanie Gaines from the County of San Diego. Can you hear me?
Yes, proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Cantu and board members. My name is Stephanie Gaines with the County of San Diego, and on behalf of the 21 San Diego co-permittees, we'd like to share an exciting and innovative approach to our regional education outreach program, the launch of our San Diego Region Behavior Change Marketing Campaign we call Project Clean Water. For years, Project Clean Water has served as a regional forum around water management and more recently as our regional clearinghouse for our regulatory documents. But with our new campaign, Project Clean Water's mission will focus on a countywide initiative dedicated to protecting water quality and inspiring others to take action to stop polluted runoff. To do this, we're bringing together government agencies, environmental and resource organizations, and individual citizens in support of clean water, healthy communities, and thriving ecosystems. One goal of the public education campaign is to raise awareness of stormwater issues and encourage behaviors that promote water quality. Part of the campaign is 52 Ways to Love Your Water, a 52-week action pledge involving weekly actions that everyone can take to protect our waterways. Over the remaining 4 years of the campaign, other messages and activities will be focused on educating the public on important issues such as stormwater being untreated, over-irrigation and gardening chemical impacts, trash and pet waste, and stormwater capture for reuse. We'll launch the campaign with a press conference on Monday, March 22nd, which also happens to be World Water Day, beginning at 10 a.m. We'll bring San Diegans from across the region to many sectors together to stand in solidarity with Project Clean Water and unify our communities and amplify our message of a cleaner and safer environment. During the press conference, our distinguished guest speakers will include County Board of Supervisor Tara Lawson-Reamer of District 3 and Mayor Catherine Blakespear of the City of Encinitas to discuss the importance of clean water, healthy communities, and call San Diegans to action on how they can do their part to protect our water quality. At 10:30 a.m., a spoken word poet, Gil Sotu, will provide an original poem on Project Clean Water, and at the same time, San Diegans will participate in a synchronized, socially distant individual paddle out at their local beach or water body. We want to encourage you to visit our website, projectcleanwater.org, to like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and Twitter, and use the handle hashtag Project Clean Water in your communications. Also, please listen for our updates and tips that will be broadcast on our local radio channels and local news media. And I would like to thank you for this time and see if you have any questions for us.
Thank you, Ms. Gaines. Mr. Abernal, you have a question.
Yes. How are you going to monitor whether or not your program is successful?
That's an excellent question, Mr. Abernal. We have a number of different metrics that we're employing, such as Google Analytics. I wish I could remember each and every one of them right now. There's about 6 different metrics that we're using to monitor website traffic, to monitor different radio hits and different news media outlet hits, different influencers. We track influencers. So there's a number of different metrics that we're going to be using on a weekly, a monthly, and a quarterly basis to see how we're doing and how we're engaging. The 52 Weeks to Love Your Water campaign is very interactive. It's actually going to be embedded on our website. And I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with the H2OC campaign, the over-irrigation campaign that they have. It's very similarly set up to that campaign where you've got a map online. It'll be on Project Clean Water, and people can go in and they can monitor where they've taken part in different activities. Periodically, we're going to incentivize things like having, t-shirts and water bottles and other promotional items, reusable type promotional items that we'll provide to participants who engage in the campaign. And then, like I said, each year we're going to focus on a little bit of a different take to kind of refresh the campaign. So where we're starting with our 52 Ways to Love Your Water and engagement and awareness of Project Clean Water as a regional resource, then we'll start to focus the next year on things like stormwater being untreated, those types of messages. And we'll build on those by talking the next year about over-irrigation and the impacts of gardening chemicals, pet waste and trash, and then stormwater capture for reuse. So when you get to the last year of the campaign, everything has built and culminated on each other. We're lucky enough to have a lot of radio time and news media time as well embedded into the campaign. So there's going to be a very public-facing part of this campaign and engagement and activities.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Ms. Warren.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to say thank you for bringing this to the board today. We really appreciate the creative thinking going into the non-point source control. And I would just ask that you put it on your calendar to come back in a year so that we can hear how the program is going and follow along with you and hopefully enjoy your success.
Oh, great. We would love to come back in a year or sooner if you'd like us to come back and tell you how exciting our campaign is running.
Sure. I mean, absolutely. We're always happy to hear good news.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Gaines?
Yeah, Stephanie? This is Jerry Strong. Hi. I may have missed it. How much buy-in and cooperation do you have from the school districts and our local nonprofits?
That's really a good question. So one of the parts of the campaign is to develop a child-friendly portion of and it's called the Wonderment, and it's going to be out there on our website as well. It's going to be embedded in the 52 Weeks to Love Your Water campaign and just on the website in general to provide a resource to local school children. It's also COPPA compliant, which means that it's got some encryption and protection in it to protect children and their identities and things like that. So that's one thing that we focused on. And you had another question, Gary. What was the second part of your question? Was it local nonprofits?
Yeah.
We've been working. Our consultant is MIG, and they've been doing a fantastic job for us. One of the things they've been doing is actually a lot of outreach to all of the local NGOs, environmental groups, different organizations throughout San Diego County. And really working with them to be a part of this campaign, to find out, you know, how we can work and spread messages together. So a lot of that is embedded in this campaign. One of the fundamental things we're doing right now is working on the launch, which is March 22nd, again, on World Water Day. And so we have a lot of support right now from our local NGOs. I can certainly follow up and provide you a list of who will be participating, if that would be helpful.
No, that's not necessary. I know there's a lot of need out there for online programs that the teachers can use to help on the online teaching. And I think a lot of that's going to continue to some extent. I know we're trying to put our Trout in a Classroom project online with some classes and some of the other, there's a Bugs Are Cool thing, I think, that the River Park's doing, and then making those available to the teachers to link into. So any kind of help you can give the teachers in that way, I'm sure will be appreciated.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good comment. Thank you.
Mr. Abarbanel, I see your hand is off screen, but I'm
right.
getting
I
from ESP.
I don't see a way to raise my hand electronically, but we'll figure that out. Ms. Gaines, my question was directed not to public relations, but to measurements of toxic waste in the San Diego River. I want to know whether or not your campaign's effective and how you intend to find out by physical means and chemical means and biological means?
Well, the campaign is a marketing campaign with the sole intention of raising awareness and educating the public to gain that type of awareness type of change, behavior change. So, you know, behavior change is going to be marked in things like I mentioned before, the metrics we're tracking for the marketing campaign are related to, you know, number of website hits, people who engage with us in our different activities, people who engage with us. So translating that to a benefit in water quality might be a little bit challenging, but one of the key things we know we need to do is we need to get people to change their behaviors. And that's what this campaign focuses on, is the behavior change aspect. That doesn't mean that we wouldn't look at it in different aspects of our program as well. We would certainly want to tie what we learn together in with our physical aspects of our program, such as, you know, water quality monitoring or any BMPs that we might want to implement, more physical structural type BMPs as opposed to non-structural type BMPs. But this is along the non-structural lines. If you'd like, we can certainly bring back some of the metrics that we do track after we start tracking the program to demonstrate effectiveness on what we're learning with behavior change and how much engagement we're getting with the public, if that would be interesting to your board.
I think we are interested in that. Thank you, Ms. Gaines. Any other questions? Thank you very much and best of luck. We're really excited to see how this rolls out. And I personally will be following you all and learning about the 52 ways to love your water.
Great. Thank you so much for your time again.
So we'll move into board business now. We'll consider adopting the board minutes of February the 10th. Does the board have any questions regarding the minutes as they were presented? Hearing none, I'll ask the clerk to call the roll.
I need a motion and a second, please.
Oh, of course.
A second.
Thank you.
Okay, Dr. Barbineau?
Aye.
Ms. Blair?
Yes.
Dr. Olson?
Aye.
Mr. Strawn?
Aye.
Ms. Warren?
Abstain.
Chair Cantu?
Aye. Motion carries. Now is the time and place for people, our board members and our state liaison executive director to share announcements and reports and different initiatives. So I'll call on the board members first. Ms. Warren.
I'm sure others will speak to this as well, but I just want to say thank you to Dave and our local representatives who participated in recent Zoom meetings. We had the chance to meet with Mayor Gloria. We had the chance to meet with Chair Fletcher, and I'm happy to hear about their water-related priorities and how we can partner with our elected officials to drive towards clean water for all. And so thank you to everyone involved in setting that up, and look forward to more engagement with our community, whether it's elected officials or our NGOs and any other constituents with the board. So thanks, Dave.
Yes, hear, hear. Thank you. Mr. Arbavadal.
Hi, I'll figure out how to raise my hand electronically afterwards. During the meeting with Nathan Fletcher from the Board of Supervisors, I think it was Dave who suggested that we might have the capability to distinguish toxic waste, especially fecal matter, from humans and other animals. And I wonder if he might comment on that, and should we involve SQRP?
SQRP is always involved in just that very topic, but go ahead.
Yes, I hope so. I think so.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Dr. Barbineau. Yes, one of the things I shared with Supervisor Chair Fletcher was our training review plans for the coming year. And in the next few weeks, you'll begin seeing the notices for that. Among the priorities that we identified is an update to our Rec 1, Rec 2 beneficial uses, also the recreational beneficial uses, and the total maximum daily load for bacterial indicators the board adopted. One of the things that we're contemplating is adopting a new water quality objective for HF-183, the genetic marker that can be used to track human sources of fecal waste, and updating the TMDL so that it does not rely exclusively on bacterial indicators as compliance, but rather on measures of human fecal waste. This follows the work that we've done with the County of San Diego, City of San Diego, County of Orange, and others on the source tracking efforts, the surfer health study, and the cost-benefit analysis of the total maximum daily load for bacterial indicators. This will be an ambitious project. It will probably take more than one triennial review cycle. But in this case, rather than simply study the issue of how to assess the safety of waters for public health, we have an outcome in mind, adoption of a new objective and adoption of a revised TMDL to address those sources. Would then be executed through the stormwater permit and other vehicles. But that is the gist of what we shared with Chair Fletcher yesterday.
Dave, is SQRP involved for the technology?
Yes, they are absolutely involved. They've been involved in this effort ongoing, even through the surfer health study and the cost benefit study. So they will be an integral part of our work plan that we share with the board when we bring that training review project to you, probably later this summer.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other reports and updates from our board members? Okay, we'll invite our state board member, Laurel Firestone, to bring us up to date on what the state is thinking about.
Great, thank you. good morning. I have a few things to go over, both to update on things that happened in the past and looking forward at the State Water Board. So at our last board meeting, we had an information item from our Deputy Director of Division of Drinking Water, who established just recently a notification level and a response level for a PFAS chemical called PFBS, perfluorobutane sulfonic acid. So that is just one chemical in a large class of chemicals, that PFAS chemicals, and is in response to the information that we got from OWEHA. And in this case, there aren't any wells known in the state that exceed those notification levels or response levels. So it wasn't super controversial. and over the next, at the next board meeting on Tuesday, we'll be getting an information item on this year's drinking water regulatory priorities. We do that annually. You know, a big take home is that Chrome 6 MCL adoption is our top priority within the drinking water regulatory program to try and get that established so there's some more certainty around what that regulatory standard will be. This month is Water Data Month, and so there's a series of data seminars that are really interesting, so encourage folks that are into that to take a look. There's a really interesting study that was looking at correlations between past redlining lending practices and today's EnviroScreen cumulative environmental health impacts scores. And so that will, there'll be a seminar on that study on March 18th, and encourage folks to look at the really helpful tools that we are using in the state. We have a number of internal listening sessions to employees around racial equity that we're doing in this month about how to ensure that the water boards are working to create a workplace where all employees feel that they can belong and contribute, and where we proactively work to eliminate systemic racism and its effects. So that will be facilitated by a third-party facilitation team and help ultimately work with the external listening sessions that we've done to help us develop a racial equity resolution, action plans, and just help inform our broader racial equity initiative work. And again, that's water boards wide, so includes not just state water board folks on that initiative, but also regional boards. We have in March workshops around a five-year safe drinking water plan that we do every 5 years to kind of do a state of the state drinking water in the state. So we have that coming up in March to the document's already been released, but some workshops to go over that. Next week, we have our Salton Sea workshop, which is annually a chance to receive public information and solicit input from the public regarding the status of phase one of the Salton Sea Management Program. And that will start at 2 p.m. on the 17th. Let's see. We've been going under, working through a really comprehensive needs analysis, including a risk assessment for public water systems, state water systems, and domestic wells, looking at cost assessment and affordability assessment for our SAFER program. And this is the first time that it'll be this extremely comprehensive set of indicators that we'll be able to evaluate statewide and provide a more comprehensive statewide picture, both of which systems are failing to provide safe drinking water, but also those that are at high risk of failing, and also some affordability analysis really at the system level. And so that should be coming out, if not by the end of this month, early April. And then we'll be holding a workshop at our board meeting, at a board meeting in April to go over those. That then informs our fund expenditure plan for the Safe and Affordable Drinking Water Fund, which will be adopted this summer and is adopted annually. One of the interesting things I think for all of us will be looking at the cost estimate and then funding gap analysis. So it can help better understand the funding gap that we have in the state to address those needs. We are also working on a statewide restoration general order. So the goal there is to help streamline regulatory processes across, Section 401 water quality certs and waste discharge requirements for restoration project type statewide. And we've been working with the regional boards, including this one, to make sure that we're designing a program that will work across the state. And we're aiming to release the draft by the end of the month and hoping to adopt before the end of the year. We issued a draft of the statewide construction stormwater general permit reissuance, a preliminary staff draft back last fall, and held some workshops, and we're planning on releasing the formal draft for public comment in April for that. We also have shared a preliminary staff draft on the statewide sanitary sewer system general order reissuance and are holding workshops around that in mid-April as well. And I guess lastly, we have our Water Rights Administration, Division of Water Rights, and we are extremely focused right now on both drought preparedness and also preparing more immediately for likely responses that we'll need to take through our Water Rights Administration actions that will be needed in this critically dry year in many areas. Even with the rains, unfortunately, we're in bad shape. And so there's a lot we're doing to internally make sure we have our processes able to anticipate and prepare as much as possible, and developing really proactive early communication and coordination with stakeholders around that. That's my update. Happy to answer any questions.
Well, that's a lot. Thank you very much. Questions for State Board Member Firestone from the board.
I'm really looking forward to this, to the information or the items on this agenda. So there's a lot of good stuff going on here in the region, and excited to learn more.
Great. Well, we'll move on to the Executive Officer's Report. Any questions for Executive Officer Gibson's report as mailed?
It's not a questions list. I just wanted to say thank you. I noticed that there was the update that I'd requested on sort of what we were doing to meet the increased demand in our public beaches and public park areas in terms of trash. So thank you for that. I appreciated it.
You're very welcome. If there aren't any other questions, I just want to mention a couple of things very briefly. Yeah, I mentioned the triennial review that we reported on to Sheriff Fletcher. I do have in my hands right now staff recommendations for that process. Of course, there's a very public side of that, and we always get many more requests for actions than we have staffing to do. But you can look forward to in coming months the updates in the executive officer's report. And right now, among the three priorities that have been identified is, of course, the Tijuana River TMDLs. And it also includes designating waters for the tribal beneficial uses that the board adopted last December. Now that we've identified those beneficial uses, it'll be time in the next triennial review cycle or two to actually identify which waters those will apply to. As I indicated in my report this month, we have attended the latest eligible public entities group. There is reason to be concerned about the future of Project One, our top priority. We have been asked by EPA, both directly and indirectly, to send in a comment letter, which I am working on with several stakeholders and hope to have that in by this Friday. And also, I'll just mention that we have been working on the update to our practical vision, and at the next month's executive officer's report, I'll share with you an outline for the approach going forward to engage the community, to provide feedback on that strategic document and the plan for bringing it to the board for its consideration. With that, that concludes my report.
Thank you. At this point, we'll invite future agenda items, recommended courses of action for agenda items. This is the opportunity for the board members to suggest agenda items. Oh, I think I saw a hand with Mr. Abravadal.
Yeah, I figured it out.
Congratulations. You've got a hand up.
Right. No, it's obscure, but I did it. One of the suggestions that came up in the discussion with Mr. Fletcher was to have a region-wide workshop sponsored by the board, maybe the County of San Diego. You and Dave can figure out who should be the hosts on the Tijuana River Valley, where we're going and what we need to do, and to invite the congressional delegations and definitely broadcast, inform the public and hope that they will attend. And I think that would be awkward on Zoom, but that's all we've got probably till the late spring or summer, but to do it maybe in the fall when we can have public attendance.
Well, that would be good. EPA did host a public session last Friday on receiving input from public members. But what you suggest would be directly inviting our elected officials. So that would be a great idea. So let's write that down as something hopefully we can organize in the future. Any other future agenda items? Okay, hearing none, we'll move into our consent calendar. We have two items on our consent agenda: waste discharge requirement rescission only because it's going to be taken over by the State Water Board, and a new waste discharge requirement with the Lakeside Investment Company. Does anybody wish that either of these two be removed from the consent agenda? Not hearing any, I'll entertain a motion to approve the consent agenda.
Excuse me, Board Chair Cantu, would you like to see if there is any members of the public who'd wish to speak on any of these items?
Thank you very much. Yes, I would very much like to know if anybody in the member of our public would be interested in pulling either of these two agenda items.
That's excellent. Right now, if any member of the public would like to speak, please virtually raise your hand in Zoom or press *9 on your phone now. Please remember to state your name for the record before you speak. Board Chair Cantu, I am looking at our list of attendees and I do not see any hands being raised at this time.
Okay, thank you very much. And thank you for reminding me that people should be given an opportunity to ask questions. So being no questions from the public, I'll entertain a motion and a second to approve the consent agenda as presented.
So moved.
Second.
Thank you, Ms. Warren. Thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none, would the clerk call the roll, please?
Dr. Barbanel?
Aye.
Ms. Blair?
Aye.
Dr. Olson?
Aye.
Mr. Strawn?
Aye.
Ms. Warren?
Aye.
Chair Cantu?
Aye. Okay, the motion carries. At this point, what is the pleasure of the board? Would you like a short 2 to 5 minute stretch opportunity? We're at 9:30 34, or should we move into our next informational item and plan a break after that between the two informational items? Should we do that? I see one nod. I see another nod. Okay, we'll keep going. Thank you very much. The first informational item is an update on asset management and infrastructure needs at the South Bay International Boundary and Water Commission Wastewater Treatment Plant. So this is an informational item concerning current and past operations of the South Bay International Water Treatment Plant, which is owned and operated by the IBWC, International Boundary and Water Commission, United States Section. The board will hear from regional board staff and from the International Boundary and Water Commission on current and past asset management and infrastructure issues at the treatment plant. The board will take no action on this matter today. This informational item will not discuss the NDBDS permit reissuance for the treatment plant. The board anticipates considering the permit reissuance in its May meeting, so this is a pending item. And because the NPDES permit is currently pending, it is important that today's discussion be limited to current and past operations of the treatment plant. Any question or comments about future operations of the treatment plant or the pending permit should be raised at the May board meeting. So we have to keep that in mind. So Vicente Rodriguez and Keith Yeager from the regional board and representatives from the International Boundary and Water Commission will give their presentation, followed by any public speakers. Mr. Rodriguez and Mr. Yeager and IBWC representatives are available to answer all of the board members' questions, along with our other staff member, Brandy Outwin-Beals and David Barker. So let's begin this presentation.
Good morning, Chair Cantu and members of the board. I am Vicente Rodriguez, a water resource control engineer with the San Diego Water Board. The purpose of this item is for the United States section of the International Boundary and Water Commission to provide a status of the operating conditions of the South Bay International Wastewater Treatment Plant. A representative of the USIBWC is here today. Her name is Sochi Aranda, and she is the acting principal engineer of operations. There are some points of interest that may come up in today's discussion: the South Bay International Wastewater Treatment Plant, Stewart Strain Diversion Berm, Junction Box 1 and Junction Box 2, the Tijuana River, and Mexican Pump Stations PB1A and PB1B. These points of interest are identified in your agenda package in Figure 1 of supporting document number 1. And just for reference, this line that I'm identifying right now, that's the international border. And Stewart Strain Collection, Canyon Collector, and JB1 are adjacent to the border. This is a corner of the International Wastewater Treatment Plant. At this time, I would like to turn over the presentation to Sochi Aranda.
Good morning, my name is Sochi Laranda, and I am the Chief of Operations and Maintenance for the USIBWC. Currently, I'm also the Acting Principal Engineer of Operations, and in the absence of an Area Operations Manager and a COR for the San Diego Field Office, I'm covering those duties as well. I have the pleasure of providing this informational presentation on Agenda Item Number 6, Update on Asset Management and Infrastructure Issues. Next slide. First, I'd like to give a quick overview of the plant operations so that it may be easier to follow when I talk about the different components. The South Bay Wastewater Treatment Plant is designed to treat 25 million gallons per day of sewage from Mexico. This Influent enters the U.S. through a 72-inch sewer into junction box number one. From there, it flows into junction box number two through a 96-inch pipe, which then continues into the headworks where it is screened for trash and debris, then pumped to the grit chamber through a 60-inch pipe. This is also where the influent meter is located. From the grit chamber, it follows into the primary sedimentation tanks, and the primary sludge is sent to the USSTs, or unstabilized sludge storage tanks. The primary effluent then flows into the activated sludge tanks through a 72-inch pipe. If those are at full capacity, the flow is diverted to the equalization tanks. From the activated sludge tanks, the effluent flows into the secondary sedimentation tanks where return activated sludge gets re-entered into the activated sludge tanks, and the waste activated sludge gets pumped for thickening and eventually into solids processing where dewatering occurs through belt presses. Next slide. As part of the new O&M contract, the contractor submitted a 5-year capital improvement plan that is currently under review. The projects that were scheduled for this fiscal year were identified as priority projects last year, and we are actively working to complete them this year. We meet on a biweekly basis to discuss each project, the progress and challenges in order to resolve any issues and ensure that we do execute these projects. The first project that has been ongoing since October of last year is the SCADA upgrades that is scheduled to be completed this year. We also started with the two influent pumps replacements last year with a 6-month lead time on delivery, which we should be getting this month and the next. In the proposal stage are the valves replacement at JV1, the influent pipe section, valves and meter replacement, and the belt filter presses rehabilitation. Next slide, please. I'll begin with the start of the treatment process, and that's at junction box number one, or JB1. As I mentioned previously, there's a 72-inch line that enters the box from Mexico and a 96-inch line that exits the box to JB2. Both of these lines had functioning valves at JB1. The sluice gate at JB1 for the 96-inch pipe cannot be operated. The track has been damaged and the gate is stuck in position. The sluice gate for the 72-inch is broken off its track. The lower picture shows the remnants of that sluice gate. This has been an ongoing issue that previous managers have tried to obtain funding in order to perform the repairs. Unfortunately, funds had not been made available until last year when Congress gave us that authority. And we've had to revisit last year's quotes from the contractor as there have been many changes due to the many challenges they're facing with executing the repair. One challenge is finding a manufacturer that makes that size of a valve. Another major challenge is finding a contractor that can perform the work on both sides of the border. Due to the proximity of the box to the international boundary line, as can be seen on the top photo, isolating the box will require plugging the line in Mexico and very close coordination with the personnel that will be entering the box, which is a very dangerous task. Nevertheless, they're making strides toward addressing these challenges, and we do plan to start work this year. Next slide, please. Moving along into the headworks, we have the influent pumps. As mentioned previously, we are expecting two influent pumps to arrive this month and next, so this work will be performed this summer. There are a total of 6 influent pumps at the headworks, 2 of which were replaced a couple years ago, and the 2 that are scheduled for replacement this summer. There will be 2 left to replace in the following 5 years. Next slide, please. Leaving the headworks, we move into the influent meter and pipe section. Excessive corrosion and leaking in a section of the influent pipe within the vault was repaired temporarily, as can be seen in the picture. However, because that was not a reliable long-term repair, an underground bypass was installed by utilizing this underground bypass, the meter that's still in place is not in use. The work that's planned for this year, replacing that section of pipe, the meter will also be upgraded and replaced. The one that's in place now is no longer in production and replacement parts are not available. So it does require an upgrade and also to be replaced for the two valves on either end of the pipe. Next slide, please. The other priority project is the belt filter presses rehabilitation. There are four belt filter presses in total, and one is completely out of service and requires complete rehabilitation. We have reviewed a preliminary quote from the contractor, and Acquisitions has sent a request for proposal for two belt presses. This work is scheduled to begin this summer as well, and the other two belt presses will be scheduled for rehabilitation in the next 5 years. Next slide, please. Our biggest challenge in getting many of these capital improvements completed was funding. Since funding had been appropriated for the addition of secondary sedimentation basins and equalization tanks, we did not receive funding for other capital improvement requirements, and they were referred to later years. Also, recently, we experienced sustained flows greater than 25 million gallons per day. This required the plant to operate without any downtime, and regular preventive maintenance had to be deferred. We are just now trying to catch up on much of that deferred maintenance, and the plant is beginning to normalize. However, in performing this maintenance, we found that repairs were required as well. Next slide, please. Here's an example of a repair that was required. All secondary sedimentation basins were in use during these high flows, and this one started failing. It had to be put out of service for a couple of months in order to perform a repair on it, but it is operational now. Next slide, please. This is another example of a repair that had to be performed. This is the waste activated sludge thickening tank. There are two of them, and one had to be put out of service for repairs to the feed line. The contractor continues to perform preventive maintenance and repair any damages discovered while servicing equipment. Next slide, please. So what lies ahead for us? With this new O&M contract, there are criteria in it that require us to continue to track all required preventive maintenance. There's a quality assurance surveillance plan that we've implemented and are carrying out. We do have, with this new O&M contract, new plant management and plant supervisor. And so they've taken on each task as per the contract. And we're making sure that preventive maintenance is being completed. Also, we plan to execute the capital projects to replace aging infrastructure. The plant is old, and many of the components at this point require complete replacement. Due to costs, we're having to rehabilitate some of them, such as the belt presses. But it really does need to be upgraded. Also, because of the our influent and the sediment that's brought in through the influent process, many of our pumps and components wear down much faster than they usually would. The lifespans are much shorter on some of these components just due to the nature of the quality of the influent that we treat. And also we will continue to request funds from Congress annually to continue with the capital plan. We place our budget requests, and that these will be aligned with the 5-year capital improvement plan to ensure that we continue to move forward, with the improvements that the plant requires. Next slide, please. And here's my contact information. If any additional information is required, my phone number and email, and I believe we can open it up to questions.
Thank you, Ms. Aranda. That was truly sobering. We'll open it up to questions from the board members. I'm looking for hands. Well, just to get us started, I have to say those are significant and substantial issues. It's very hard to perform your mission with so many of the components of the plant not performing. I understand the difficulties with getting appropriations from the federal government in a timely fashion, but clearly you must have reserve accounts and you must have routine preventive maintenance budgeted. I mean, it just seems that these are numerous and significant, and it's very sobering. Are there not reserve accounts that you can call on to take care of the problems when they're smaller before they completely break off, for example, in terms of the valve?
As far as funding, I'm not privy to all the funding within the agency. I am aware of an emergency funds that the commissioner has access to, but again, we cover the border, and I know of other emergency repairs that have been required and have had to use the emergency funds. Again, I'm not sure what all the funding component of it is. I at this point I request it. I put it in my budget request, and I you know push to have that available. And then in the past, again, this is a new realm for me, so I can't really speak much about the past, and those before me have since retired. So all I can do is pick up the pieces from here and move forward as quickly as possible.
I understand, and I don't mean to embarrass you, and I appreciate your presentation, but I just had no idea that the problems were so numerous and substantial. I mean, we've been aware of upsets and problems and challenges historically, but it just seems like what you have described here is a very difficult plant to operate under the circumstances. Even at the 25 MGD, and I know you routinely get significantly over the 25 MGD, and it is full of sediment, and it is particularly challenging for any well-maintained modern plant, let alone one that is suffering as this one is.
Yes, I agree. And just from a personal opinion, it just seemed like everything just came to its age all at once, and we're having to address and prioritize as best as we can. But no, I agree. It is a challenge, and the operators are doing a fantastic job keeping it online.
Good. Any questions for Ms. Aranda from the board?
Just Mr. Brown? I remember when I first got on this board that there was at least a new part of this plant that was being opened. How old is the plant itself, and is it all one vintage, or if I remember right, there was some additions?
Right. So the additions were done in 2016, I believe, and it was the addition of secondary sedimentation and equalization tanks, and the plant itself is over 30 years old, and so many components are at least 30 years old.
Is the newer section holding up okay, or is it also being inundated by the type of influence that we're having to deal with?
The the sedimentation tank that had to be repaired was one of the newer ones, and so it's going through just as much wear and tear as the rest of the plant.
Okay.
Any questions from board members? Any further questions? Any questions from staff before we thank Ms. Aranda for her presentation?
Board Chair Cantu, would the board also be interested in hearing from members of the public? We do have two speakers. Great. I'll go ahead and call Chris Helmer.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, Mr. Yes. Helmer.
All right. Thank you. Well, good morning, board. This is Chris Helmer from the City of Imperial Beach. And I really want to thank the Water Board and the staff for really leading the efforts in the Tioga River Valley to solve the transboundary pollution crisis. And I really want to thank IBWC for providing an update on the issues at IBWC plant. And I hope that we can continue to receive more of these frequent updates from IBWC on all the other issues that are going on in the River Valley. While I'm encouraged IBWC reports that they have a plan to resolve the current crisis, I remain extremely frustrated about the lack of information and the lack of emergency response to the issues that continue to contribute to transboundary pollution at the border. I'm also frustrated that there's some important facts that seem to remain unanswered. Did the failure at Junction Box 1 contribute to the intentional discharge of sewage from CESS, this is the Mexican Wastewater Agency, into the river, or result in additional sewage spills at Smuggler's Gulch? Why has there not been any additional water quality monitoring or of transboundary flows at Derrymar Bridge, like IBWC has done in the past? I can tell you the bacteria concentrations at the beach have been exceptionally high over the last 3 months just from the existing monitoring that we do. Why were agencies not formally alerted to the issues at the IBWC plant last August? And more importantly, why were agencies so slow to respond to this emergency crisis? For any other agency in California, the discharge of sewage would be considered an emergency. The failure of intake infrastructure at any treatment plant would also be an emergency. It just doesn't sit right that in the Tijuana River, this is considered business as usual. And then what can be done to help prevent similar failures in the future? IBWC holds a unique responsibility for binational coordination on wastewater and pollution issues in the Tijuana River. And it's frustrating that we're not seeing more progress in Tijuana River Valley from their role as a facilitator for this binational coordination. But at the end of the day, I hope we all learn from this latest incident and come away with solutions that result in greater transparency and support to solve the multiple issues that we're facing here in Tijuana River Valley. All agencies are currently involved in the efforts to help shape a comprehensive solution in the transboundary pollution crisis. From the Imperial Beach perspective, we want to see these solutions succeed, but realize that it will require every agency in the River Valley, including IBWC, including the San Diego Water Board, to effectively utilize every tool at our disposal to ensure that our actions finally solve the crisis in the river. So thank you very much for giving this opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Mr. Helmer. Do we have another question or presentation from the public?
We do. Stephanie Bauer.
Ms. Bauer.
Good morning. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, please proceed.
Fantastic. So thank you, Chair Cantu and board members. I am Stephanie Bauer, and I'm a senior environmental specialist at the Port of San Diego. The Port of San Diego really appreciates the opportunity to provide comments relating to information item number 6 and on ongoing transboundary pollution issues in the Tijuana River Valley. First, we would also like to thank the board and Dave Gibson and his staff for putting this item on the agenda and continuing to pay attention to this matter. As an environmental champion and state designated trustee for beach and submerged lands in Imperial Beach, the Port of San Diego is committed to continue to working with its regional, state, and local partners to finally solve this public health and environmental crisis and to stop the discharge of sewage and trash to the Tijuana River Valley and the Pacific Ocean. The Port continues to work cooperatively, with the coalition of local state stakeholders and the San Diego Regional Board to identify solutions to address the transboundary pollution crisis in the Tijuana River Valley, including the improvements to the South Bay International Boundary and Water Commission Wastewater Treatment Commission treatment plant. The Port concurs with the comments made by the City of Imperial Beach and continues to encourage all agencies, including the Regional Board and the IBWC, to use all available tools with implementing solutions to address the transboundary pollution crisis. Thank you very much for the time to make a comment.
Board Chair Cantu, we have one more speaker, Gabriela Torres.
Ms. Torres, please proceed.
Hi, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good morning, and thank you. Good morning. My name is Gabriela Torres, and I am the policy coordinator for Surf Rider San Diego. Thank you very much for the opportunity to address you here today. I work exclusively for Surf Rider San Diego Clean Border Water Now campaign. I found today's presentation by the International Boundary and Water Commission incredibly informative. So thank you very much, Xochitl, for providing that information. I think this is the first update I've had on the progress that you're making. As you know, Surf Rider San Diego follows very closely all issues related to transboundary pollution at the U.S.-Mexico border. Today, I just would like to highlight Surf Rider's concern and discontent regarding the IBWC's lack of communication in the past with the public and also with stakeholders on this very important issue. I am also very frustrated that I do not believe that in the past, IBWC has fulfilled its reporting obligations under its permit. Surf Rider believes that these are important in order for us to be able to protect the environment and also public health. I would encourage the IBWC to work more closely with organizations like Surf Rider in order to reach the community in a more easy and accessible way. I'd also like to ask if you would please consider sharing the slides from today's presentation, Xochitl, and thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Ms. Torres. Any other comments from the public?
No other hands are raised at this time.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from staff or comments from staff?
Chair Cantu, thank you very much. I'd like to thank our speaker today, Xochitl Aranda. With the commission going through a change right now with an acting commissioner, an acting area manager, an acting plant superintendent, you carrying several of the jobs at once, I wanted to express the board's appreciation for your making the time today to provide this detailed and sobering update. And though I know our staff are on regular communication, do please reach out to us on a regular ongoing basis if you'd like to schedule regular meetings, even weekly, so that we can be apprised and understand how we can help during this time. That would be much appreciated. But thank you very much for your time today.
No, thank you for having me. It was it gives me the opportunity to make those connections as well, as we've not been able to meet in person, but hopefully soon.
Thank you, and please share with the other people in the organization. I know so many of them are acting like you are, that our expectation is that there would be a plant that would be maintained in such a way that it could perform as it was designed. And it seems that you are left with a plant that is unable to perform as it was designed, given the lack of preventive maintenance and reinvestment in capital improvements. So we note that. And thank you very much for your time, and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Okay, why don't we take a 5-minute stretch break now? I have 10:04, so we'll come back at, let's say, 10:10, an even number. Thank you very much.
Dave, are you there?
Ten, are we ready to reconvene and proceed? Okay, we're going to get started again. Agenda item number 7. Is the State of the Ocean Report by the City of San Diego. And this is also an informational item to hear the State of the Ocean Report from the City of San Diego regarding status and trends of water quality conditions in the vicinity of the Point Loma Ocean Outfall and the South Bay Ocean Outfall. This report is required by the Monitoring Reporting Program in the city's NPDES permit for the South Bay Water Reclamation Plant, Order Regional Board 9-2013-006. The board will hear from Regional Board staff, representatives from the city, and members of the public on the State of the Ocean report. The board will not take any action today. So same statement as before, this informational item shall not discuss the NPDES permit reissuance for the South Bay Water Reclamation Plant. The board anticipates considering the permit reissuance at its May meeting. And because the permit is currently pending, it is important that today's discussion be limited to past monitoring results and observations of water quality conditions. Any questions or comments about future monitoring efforts or the NPDES permit reissuance should be raised at the May board meeting. Keith Yeager from the regional board and representatives from the city will give their presentation, followed by any public speakers. Mr. Yeager and the city representatives will be available to answer board members' questions, along with Brandy Outwin Beals and David Barker. So let us proceed. Who gets to start? Keith?
Yep.
You have the look of a person about to start.
Can you guys see my screen?
We can.
Good day, members of the board. I am Keith Yeager, an environmental scientist with the Source Control Regulation Unit. I will provide a brief introduction to item 7 on today's agenda. Dr. Ryan Kempster, senior marine biologist from the City of San Diego's Public Utilities Department, will then present the State of the Ocean Report. The City of San Diego conducts an extensive ocean monitoring program to evaluate the environmental impacts associated with the discharge of treated wastewater from the Point Loma Wastewater Treatment Plant, which discharges through the Point Loma Ocean Outfall, and from the city's South Bay Water Reclamation Plant and the United States International Boundary and Water Commission's International Wastewater Treatment Plant, which discharged the South Bay Ocean Outfall. In 2017, the San Diego Water Board aligned the monitoring reporting programs contained in the NPDES permits for all three wastewater treatment plants to essentially create a single comprehensive ocean monitoring program for the two outfalls.
Hello.
This is CPS Pharmacy.
The monitoring program covers an area spanning roughly 340 square miles of coastal marine waters from northern San Diego County to northern Baja California and Mexico. The NPDES permits for the Point Loma Ocean Outfall and South Bay Ocean Outfall require the dischargers to monitor water and sediment quality and fish and vertebrate community structure. The picture on the left shows the fixed monitoring stations, and the picture on the right shows the randomly selected benthic monitoring stations for 2019. In addition to the core monitoring requirements, the city also conducts several special studies, such as plume tracking and satellite imagery. Among other things, these special studies provide insight on the location and dispersion of the wastewater plume discharged through the outfalls. It can provide context to the results of the core receiving water monitoring. The NPDES permits for both outfalls require the dischargers to present the State of the Ocean report to the board every other year. We have added the same requirement to other recently adopted NPDES permits, such as those for the Oceanside and Encina Ocean outfalls. The State of the Ocean report is consistent with Chapter 2 of the Practical Vision, as it effectively and transparently communicates the findings and conclusions of the ocean monitoring conducted in the vicinity of the Point Loma and South Bay Ocean outfalls, as required by the NPDES permits. I will now turn it over to Dr. Kempster for the State of the Ocean report.
Thank you, Mr. Yeager. Dr. Kempster.
Thank you. Thanks, Keith. Good morning. My name is Dr. Ryan Kempster. I'm the senior marine biologist with the City of San Diego's Environmental Monitoring and Technical Services Division, or EMTS. I'm here today to present the State of the Ocean report, which summarizes data collected by the city's ocean monitoring program during the 2018-2019 reporting period, as per the requirements of the city's National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permits, or NPDES. Next slide, Keith. For further information on everything that I will be discussing today, you can download the complete report via the City of San Diego website as shown on the screen, or simply do a search for the San Diego Ocean Monitoring Program. Next slide, Keith. The EMTS division is part of the city's public utilities department with a staff of over 200 people who are tasked with monitoring and assessment of water resources to determine regulatory compliance to preserve and protect environmental and public health for all of San Diego. Next slide, Keith. Within the EMTS division is the Marine Biology and Ocean Operations team, which I oversee, and is tasked with the management of the city's ocean monitoring program. Collectively, my team of 20 staff have over 200 years of marine science experience. For perspective, I've been with the city now for just over a year. So on your screen right now, you are looking at the true experts of this program, as these are the people that make this program possible. They ensure that the boats are out on the water collecting samples no matter the weather. They ensure that the data collected is quality controlled, and they make it possible for me to appear in front of you today to share the real results of this great work. Next slide, Keith. The ocean monitoring program revolves around two major ocean outfalls, the Point Loma ocean outfall and the South Bay ocean outfall. The Point Loma ocean outfall discharges treated wastewater from the Point Loma wastewater treatment plant, and the South Bay ocean outfall discharges commingled treated wastewater from the South Bay water reclamation plant and the International Wastewater Treatment Plant. Each plant is issued an NPDES permit, which requires the monitoring of the marine environment around the outfalls to ensure there is no negative impact as a result of the discharge. Next slide, Keith. Some of the core sampling stations that make up part of the ocean monitoring program are shown here on this map, highlighting the extent of the program from the shoreline to offshore waters and into northern Mexico. Next slide. By way of a little history, an earlier form of the ocean monitoring program began in 1963, at the same time that discharge first began from the Point Loma wastewater treatment plant. In 1991, the ocean monitoring program was expanded to prepare for the extension of the Point Loma ocean outfall to its current location, 4.5 miles offshore, which went into operation in 1993. Next slide. By 1995, the ocean monitoring program expanded further to cover the South Bay region in preparation for the discharge of treated wastewater from the International Wastewater Treatment Plant in 1999, which was later commingled with discharge from the South Bay Water Reclamation Plant in 2002. Next slide. The ocean monitoring program is extensive and covers a wide range of data collection efforts, but for the purposes of today's presentation, I have summarized the findings under the following four major categories: water quality, sediment quality, community structure and health, and finally, plume tracking. Next slide. Water quality samples are taken throughout the region to measure the density of fecal indicator bacteria, or FIB. These bacterial measurements include total coliforms, fecal coliforms, and enterococcus. Evaluations of FIBs can help to identify sources of contamination. The city's water quality monitoring efforts are also designed to assess compliance with the bacterial water contact standards and other physical and chemical water quality objectives specified in the California Ocean Plan, which are intended to help protect the beneficial uses of state ocean waters. Next slide. Permanent water quality stations are distributed throughout the region from La Jolla to northern Mexico, with 19 shoreline stations, 15 nearshore stations, and 69 offshore stations. Don't worry too much about the specific sampling station locations, as I will be showing a few maps like this one throughout the presentation, but I just wanted to give you a sense of the sampling area involved. Next slide. When we isolate just the shoreline stations, we see that 87% of the over 1,800 samples taken during the reporting period were in compliance with water quality objectives for bacteria specified in the ocean plan. However, it should be noted that not all of the stations included in this percentage are applicable to ocean plan objectives, as you will see in a few moments. Next slide. As we move further away from shore, compliance increases significantly to 96% of the over 4,600 samples in the near shore, and then further still to 97% of the over 1,600 samples in offshore waters. Next slide. If we flip these percentages around for a moment and look at how many of these are non-compliant samples were measured during the wet season, we see an interesting pattern emerge. For those stations close to shore, approximately 80 to 86% of samples showing elevated FIB were sampled during the wet season. Conversely, for the small number of offshore samples with elevated FIB, there does not appear to be any relationship with rainfall, with approximately half of the samples being recorded in the wet season and half in the dry season. Therefore, it is quite clear that rainfall is having a significant effect on water quality in inshore waters, which makes sense when we consider that during the wet season, significant amounts of terrestrial runoff may occur. Next slide. Outflows from the San Diego River, San Diego Bay, the Tijuana River, and the Los Brenos Creek can flush contaminants into nearshore coastal waters, not to mention stormwater outflows throughout the region, which likely result in higher levels of FIB in inshore waters. Next slide. By focusing on the stations that show the greatest number of samples with elevated FIB, we see that just 10 stations account for 66% of all samples with elevated FIB, and all of these stations are located at the mouth of the Tijuana River or south of the border. Next slide. By narrowing this down a little further, we see that just 4 stations account for 40% of all samples with elevated FIB. These stations are located directly in front of the Tijuana River and the Los Brenos Creek. Next slide. As mentioned earlier, as far as permit compliance is concerned, the Ocean Plan water quality objectives only apply to state jurisdictional waters, which extend offshore by 3 nautical miles. Therefore, when only considering stations for which the Ocean Plan objectives apply, compliance increases to greater than 96%. Next slide. Thus, results from the 2018-2019 reporting period show that the receiving waters meet water quality standards established by the California Ocean Plan. Next slide. Analyses of various sediment contaminants are conducted by the city as anthropogenic inputs into the marine ecosystem, such as that from municipal wastewater, can possibly lead to increased concentrations of pollutants. The relative proportions of sand, silt, clay, and other particle size parameters are also examined as concentrations of some compounds are known to be directly linked to sediment composition. Understanding changes in sediment condition and quality over time and space is thus crucial to assessing corresponding changes in benthic invertebrate and demersal fish populations. Next slide. For the purposes of monitoring sediment quality, there are 22 permanent monitoring stations in the Point Loma region and 27 in the South Bay region. Additionally, 40 stations not shown on the map are randomly assigned each year. Finally, between 2016 and 2019, 49 stations were sampled throughout the region with the specific objective of assessing sediment toxicity. Next slide. Particle size composition varied throughout the region, but generally followed typical patterns of sediments becoming finer with increasing depths. Point Loma sediments composed primarily of fine silts and clays, with a notable increase in fine particles during this reporting period. However, there was no evidence that fine particles have been accumulating over time at any of the core stations since wastewater discharge began. In the South Bay, seafloor sediments were typically a little coarser than the Point Loma region, but showed more diversity in size across stations. Like the Point Loma region, there were no spatial patterns in sediment composition relative to the proximity of the South Bay discharge site. Next slide. Sediment quality was good throughout the South Bay and Point Loma outfall regions in terms of both presence and concentration of key chemical contaminants. Although concentrations of various organic indicators, trace metals, pesticides, PCBs, and PAHs varied widely in sediments throughout both outfall regions, levels were typically below historical averages as indicated by the red line. Next slide. Furthermore, all contaminants were below the effects range low and or effects range medium thresholds, indicating that toxic effects would be unlikely, and there was no evidence of degraded habitats based on the distribution patterns of these contaminants. Next slide. For the purposes of assessing sediment toxicity, juvenile amphipods were exposed to sediments from throughout the region for a period of 10 days. Toxicity was measured primarily by amphipod mortality at the end of the test period. Next slide. With a greater than 90% survival rate considered acceptable and indicative of reference conditions, as indicated by the red line, no evidence of sediment toxicity was observed at any offshore station tested in the San Diego region during the past 4 years, regardless of depth, sediment type, or proximity to either outfall. These results are consistent with findings from previous regional monitoring programs that have demonstrated minimal sediment toxicity on the Southern California continental shelf in contrast to offshore submarine canyons and local embayments. Next slide. Therefore, there is no evidence of sediment toxicity throughout the region, and sediment quality is comparable to historic levels with no sign of contamination associated with the onset of wastewater discharge from either the Point Loma Ocean outfall or the South Bay Ocean outfall. Next slide. The city conducts extensive monitoring of soft bottom marine macrobenthic communities, bottom dwelling fishes, and relatively large megabenthic surface dwelling invertebrates to identify possible effects of wastewater discharge. These communities are targeted because such organisms play important ecological roles in coastal marine ecosystems. Because benthic invertebrates and trawled species, such as those collected by the city, live on or near the seafloor, they are exposed to sediment conditions, which may be affected by discharge from ocean outfalls, outflows from rivers and bays, or the disposal of dredged sediments. To further investigate the prevalence of contaminants in the environment, selected fish species are targeted and assessed for bioaccumulated contaminants in both liver and muscle tissue. For these reasons, assessment of bottom-dwelling fishes and invertebrate communities has become an important focus of ocean monitoring programs throughout the world. Next slide. 49 permanent benthic stations, 13 trawl and 2 rig fishing stations are located throughout the region from La Jolla to northern Mexico, with an additional 40 random benthic stations, not shown on the map, assigned annually. A number of dedicated zones, also not shown, are assigned for the collection of fish for the purposes of assessing bioaccumulation of contaminants. Next slide. Throughout the Point Loma and South Bay regions, 55 species of fish were identified from over 11,000 individuals caught during the reporting period. 75 megabenthic invertebrates were identified from over 66,000 individuals caught, and finally 894 species of benthic invertebrates were identified from over 54,000 individuals. Next slide. The Pacific sand dab and the speckled sand dab were the most common fish species found in the Point Loma and South Bay regions, respectively. The pelagic red crab and bay shrimp were the most common megabenthic invertebrates, and 2 species of polychaete worms were the most common benthic invertebrates. Although communities varied by location, depth, and sediment type, there was no evidence of disturbance or significant environmental degradation that could be attributed to anthropogenic factors such as wastewater discharge. Instead, these communities segregated by habitat characteristics relevant to their ecological niche. Next slide. External examinations of fishes captured indicate that fish populations remained healthy off San Diego, with less than 0.4% of trawl caught fish having external parasites and abnormalities reported for just 0.06% of fishes collected. And there were no incidences of fin rot or tumors on any fish sample during the last 2 years. Furthermore, results do not indicate any evidence to suggest that contaminant loads in fishes collected from the Point Loma or South Bay regions were affected by wastewater discharge in either region. Although several different trace metals, pesticides, and PCBs were detected in both liver and muscle tissue, these contaminants occurred in fishes distributed throughout both regions with no patterns that could be attributed to wastewater discharge via the outfalls. Contaminants were generally within ranges reported previously for Southern California fishes, and all samples were below state and federal action limits. Next slide. If we take a look at the benthic invertebrates, due to their sessile nature, changes in community structure are likely to be indicative of some form of environmental change, which may indicate an effect of wastewater discharge. Next slide. Using the Benthic Response Index, or BRI, we can assess whether changes in community structure may represent possible habitat degradation. The BRI is essentially an abundance-weighted average pollution tolerance of species occurring in a sample. A number of 24 or lower would be indicative of reference conditions. 25 to 34 may indicate a minor deviation from the reference conditions. And finally, 34 or more likely indicates some form of habitat degradation. Next slide. When we look at BRI values for the Point Loma and South Bay stations between 2018 and 2019, we see that all stations represent reference conditions, with the sole exception of station E14 directly at the end of the Point Loma ocean outfall, which indicates a possible minor deviation. However, it is important to note that this station has a higher proportion of coarse sediment particles and lower proportion of fine particles. This difference in habitat may contribute to an elevated BRI, as it may decrease the presence of certain pollution-sensitive species that are known to prefer finer sediments. Next slide. Overall, fish and invertebrate communities remain healthy, and there is no evidence of disturbance or significant environmental degradation that could be attributed to anthropogenic factors such as wastewater discharge. Next slide. Differentiating the wastewater effluent plume from the surrounding water body is essential to better understand the potential impacts of wastewater discharge on ocean conditions. Natural chemical tracers can be leveraged to detect and distinguish an outfall's effluent signal from other non-point sources. For example, colored dissolved organic matter, or CDOM, has proved useful in identifying wastewater plumes from the Point Loma and South Bay ocean outfalls. The reliability of plume detection can be further improved by combining measurements of CDOM with additional metrics such as chlorophyll A concentrations. Furthermore, other remote monitoring techniques, such as satellite imagery and remote moorings, can be utilized to better understand plume movements. Next slide. The city currently utilizes all three of these techniques to monitor effluent plume dispersion throughout the region. Each of the methods have positive attributes from mobility, wide coverage, and continuous data collection, but equally so, they each have a downside, including gaps between data collection, surface-only observations, and static monitoring. Therefore, by combining all three techniques, we are able to take advantage of the benefits of all of them. Next slide. Based on quarterly monitoring data, we see that approximately 23 to 27% of plume detections occur immediately at the outfall discharge site in the Point Loma and South Bay regions, respectively. In the Point Loma region, the majority of possible plume detections, which equated to 76% of all detections, occurred at the furthest offshore stations north and south of the outfall, and no detections were observed above the 24-meter depth. In contrast, in the South Bay region, no distinct pattern in plume dispersion could be identified beyond the outfall itself, likely due to the close proximity of the Tijuana River. Next slide. If we take a look at satellite data, we confirm that the plume from the Point Loma ocean outfall has not been observed at the surface, whereas the plume from the South Bay ocean outfall has been documented at the surface, but only during the winter time when the water column is less stratified, allowing for more water mixing. For both the Point Loma and South Bay ocean outfalls, there is no documented shoreward movement of the plume. Next slide. Finally, by using permanent oceanographic moorings positioned at the end of the Point Loma and South Bay ocean outfalls, we can build a more complete picture to confirm what the quarterly monitoring data and satellite images are telling us about plume behavior. Real-time oceanographic moorings such as these are equipped with a range of sensors from the surface to the seabed, which can transmit data in real-time over Wi-Fi to a land-based server for 24-hour monitoring. For the purposes of today's discussion, we are only going to touch on a small aspect of what these moorings are capable of. Next slide. What you are seeing here is temperature data collected from the Point Loma and South Bay moorings from the surface to the seabed with the summertime, July through September, highlighted by the dashed boxes. Although more pronounced in the Point Loma region due to the greater depth, you can see distinct surface warming in both regions during this period, which results in a highly stratified water column with the warmer layers above trapping the colder layers below. Next slide. By highlighting the winter months, December through February, we see a much more mixed, less stratified water column. Therefore, as pointed out previously, the plume in the South Bay region only surfaces during these winter months when the water column is less stratified, and given the shallow depth, the greater mixing allows for the plume to rise to the surface. However, in the Point Loma region, we don't typically see the plume surface even during the winter months when the water column is less stratified, as the depth alone likely inhibits it from reaching the surface waters. Next slide. Finally, by looking at ocean currents, we see that throughout the water column in both the South Bay and Point Loma regions, the currents predominantly follow a northwesterly and southeasterly direction, depending on depth, further highlighting the findings of the quarterly monitoring data and satellite images, which show that wastewater plumes stay offshore and do not move shoreward. Next slide. Therefore, there was no evidence that wastewater discharged to the ocean by either the Point Loma or the South Bay Ocean outfalls reached recreational waters along the shore or nearshore kelp beds. Results of water quality monitoring over the past 29 years off of Point Loma and 25 years off of the South Bay are consistent with observations from remote sensing studies which show a lack of shoreward transport of the wastewater plumes from either outfall. This is further supported by previous studies which have indicated that the Point Loma Ocean outfall plume typically remains submerged in deeper waters. Monitoring results specifically for the shallower South Bay Ocean outfall region are also consistent with past studies which indicate other sources such as terrestrial runoff or outflows from rivers and creeks were more likely to impact coastal water quality than wastewater discharge from the outfall, especially during and immediately after significant rain events. Next slide. To summarize, receiving waters meet water quality standards. Sediment quality is comparable to historic levels and shows no evidence of sediment toxicity. Communities are unaffected by wastewater discharge, and wastewater plumes show no shoreward movement. Next slide. So with that, I'd just like to thank you for your time today. If you would like to learn more about the program and the data we collect, I have left a link on the screen for more information. However, I'd be happy to try and answer any questions that you might have now, but also feel free to email me if you have any questions in the future. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Kimster. I see Dr. Ababanal's hand is up.
Yes. Thank you very much, Dr. Kimster. I wonder if you can go back to the slide that had a graphic of survival versus something else.
That'd be the toxicity slide, possibly. Keith, I don't know if you can pull that up.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the number on the slide, or I would have.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly which one it is. I think I'll have to just skip through so we get to it.
Sorry.
Yeah, there's a lot in this thing.
Did you want the sediment toxicity slide? Is that what you said?
No, survival.
Yeah, I think it was the amphipod. Yeah, the sediment toxicity. So it should be the next slide coming up.
Okay.
That one.
Unless I missed it, and I'm sorry if I did, you didn't explain what the arrows are on the dots.
So from the studies each year, these are the ranges in values that they were getting in those years. Obviously, the data that you're seeing today, you know, is very much a kind of high-level overview of the data we're collecting. So it's very summarized compared to what we put in our annual report.
So is that one standard deviation, or is that what you're saying?
Honestly, I would have to defer to the report. We have sediment toxicity is not under my specific management. So we do have a team that specifically works on our sediment toxicity. So I'd have to kind of defer to the report in terms of the specifics of the data being presented.
So if I could, I have two more questions that are related.
Yeah, sure.
Throughout your presentation, which was very thorough, and I certainly appreciated it, I did not hear any discussion of the errors in the measurements. Without a discussion of the errors, we can take your presentation to be estimates of a mean, but we don't know what the standard deviation is. And that's my first question. Why are those standard deviations, the errors in the measurements, not presented? And my second question is, when you talked about offshore currents sweeping, if I may call it that, or transporting toxic sediments or toxic chemical waste to the shore, that must change when you have a local storm that brings those waters to the beaches, namely to the communities. And a corollary of that question is, as climate changes, and atmospheric rivers and other phenomena intensify, what should we expect in the future?
Yeah, no problem. Just to address the first question in regards to the data there, as I mentioned, in terms of today's presentation, we're really just going for kind of a high-level overview of the results. As I'm sure you can appreciate, the program is very extensive and it involves a lot of information. And if you've had the opportunity to look at our reports, you know, I think the entire report with the addendum and all is in the region of 800 pages. And so certainly the information that you're seeking is absolutely there and available in the report. And then in regards to just the data itself as well, we have a very thorough and robust data processing and quality assurance process, which is very much follows the guidance of the board. And so it's certainly all there, and all the information you're seeking is certainly present in that report. So I certainly encourage you to check that out. The second part of the question. So in terms of the current movement, so these are obviously, again, these are kind of the broader movements in the local area that we're kind of showing here. And this is commonly what we see. In terms of kind of localized events and changes, of course, things can change on a spatial and temporal scale locally. But predominantly, we see these kind of offshore bound currents that don't come in inshore. Of course, if that did change to a significant degree, then that's something that we would report to the board and we would have conversations about that. But historically, this has just not been the case, and it's not something that has certainly come up as a concern to date. But of course, as we progress, and as you pointed out, with climate change in mind, these are things that we always want to keep in mind. And it just kind of exemplifies the value of a program like this, that we're continually monitoring and always there to check and see if there's kind of changes in local conditions that are then going to potentially have differing effects going forward.
My question follows up on Henry's question. It also occurred to me, what factors should the board be aware of or concerned about going forward that could alter those sort of the long-term patterns of keeping the plume offshore beyond climate change? I mean, that seems to me unfortunately the obvious one. But what else should we be aware of as we like make our policy decisions and consider the big picture for the health of the region?
Board Member Warren, if I just may interject really quickly, I think some of your question goes to the monitoring that might go be part of the upcoming permit consideration, and your question might be better presented at that discussion.
We can hold it. Thanks.
Thank you. No problem. But just with that in mind, though, you know, I think we do have I consider having an excellent relationship with the board, and we are we're so fortunate to have this extensive program here. And I think having that continued good collaboration and communication with you at the board is great to allow us to consider these things as we go forward into the future, and we think about climate change and potential changes that come on the horizon. So we'd certainly be more than happy to sit down with you anytime to have these kind of conversations. And I can certainly bring my experts from the team who have much more insight into the various aspects of the program to provide insights and guidance.
I would just, in this topic actually just came up recently in my house. And I just wonder, following up on questions about earlier presentations, is this data available to our elementary schools and science students who are looking at this? Because I think it's naturally intriguing, at least apparently to fifth graders. And the satellite imagery that you have is so interesting and I can kind of like explains what you're doing and what the city's trying to do and how we manage wastewater. And I just wonder how publicly available this information. I mean, obviously it's all in the report, but is it in a context? Is it packaged in a way that's more accessible to younger audiences anywhere?
Well, that is a wonderful question, because it is something we are very focused on right now, actually. So historically and currently, the data for the program is all publicly available. The only caveat to that is that we ensure that we take the data through a full quality assurance, quality control process before we then make it available, because we just want to make sure there's no errors, any issues with the data. So depending on the data set, there's certain timelines of when data set will become available, but we certainly endeavor to make that available as quickly as possible. Typically in the past, that has involved either contacting a member of staff, and we can literally just send whatever is requested and has gone through those processes. We've recently tried to improve that process by making things more readily available. So right now we do have data online with the city where you can literally directly download an Excel file of all the different parameters we're working with. And, you know, as you pointed out, great for classrooms if they want to look at real data and really kind of assess what's going on in their local community. So that's fantastic. And something we're pushing forward with at the moment is really kind of revamping our outreach efforts. And so we're producing a whole bunch of videos right now on the different things we do. With that, we're trying to kind of improve our website to make that data just more readily available, more accessible. So I would just say at the moment, access to it is, it's a little bit tricky to find where you need to go. So it's, you know, if you kind of shoot one of us an email, or if, you know, if you just search Ocean Monitoring Program, it'll take you to our website, and there is an option through there to contact one of us, and then we can facilitate that. But certainly going forward, we're going to be improving that whole process and making a lot more things available.
Thank you. Dr. Barbernal, did you have all of your questions presented? Did you have something else?
I don't have any more questions. I have a comment when we come to our comment period on this.
Okay. Any more questions from our board members? I have one. How many, or what percentage or absolute count of your monitoring stations were in the deeper canyons?
Ooh, that is a very good question. And I certainly don't know off the top of my head. Oh, here we go. I have my team members on hand sending me notes right now, and they are telling me we do not have any sampling sites in the canyons.
Thank you. Okay, we'll open it to comments then. Dr. Barbernal, you have a comment?
You can call me Henry. This was a very thorough and pretty presentation, but I would like to ask the executive officer to convey to the city of San Diego that it is not sufficient to refer us to an 800-page document to find out what's going on. I'd rather they skipped the pictures and gave us the facts. I don't think they're lying. That's not my point. But I don't know how we can make an assessment without the information they have that they didn't present. We would never let industrial discharger get away with this kind of presentation. And I don't think we should allow our jurisdictions to do so. I'm very disappointed. I also don't think they answered Stephanie's question. She asked about information available to fifth graders, for example, but you can't send an Excel sheet to a fifth grader and have them understand what the issues are or how to learn something about it. That's not an acceptable answer. I'm sorry if I seem very disappointed, but I am.
Thank you. Any questions or comments from the public? Mr. Mitchell, do you have anyone?
Board Chair Cantu, I do not see any members of the public wishing to speak, but just as a reminder for the public, if they do wish to speak and address the board, they can go ahead and do so now by virtually raising their hand in Zoom or by pressing *9 on their phone. While we wait to see if we have any members of the public who wish to speak, I do see that Board Member Olson does have her hand raised.
Yes, Dr. Olson.
I did want to ask one question. I did look at your report to some degree, and I found it kind of difficult that, in a sense, parts of it weren't integrated. You know, you had to look at the data and then you had to go back and look at your field sites and vice versa. And so I assume the arrows were, maybe I just didn't read the chart correctly, but I assume the arrows were standard deviations. But what you're telling me is the arrows are a range. Is that correct?
I actually just spoke with my team about this, and I can confirm that on this particular figure we're looking at right now, this is a standard deviation. But just, I think my response was just kind of broadly to the presentation that, you know, it's just kind of, it was kept at a kind of high level to help everyone kind of digest the information we're sharing, because there is a lot of information. But certainly just kind of to address prior comments as well, we are absolutely happy to provide whatever information the board is interested in. And so we have no issues whatsoever kind of putting this in a different format. And so, you know, we're very open to suggestions.
So I'm not exactly sure if this question is more applicable to this time frame or the time frame later in May, but I expect someone will inform me on it. Now, you do have areas, particularly in the shoreline, that are, or at least in this, in your data, showed were elevated. And so I wonder, when you look at that, and then you told us overall everything was fine, I don't quite understand how to interpret that. So you're telling me you have, when you average all your samples, they're all in compliance. Yet, or you're telling me over time, you've taken all these samples, and over time, they are in compliance, although at certain times of the year they're out of compliance. Is that what the data are showing? Or in not your report. Your report doesn't show, but the as it was presented today.
Yeah. So I think it's important to distinguish the cause of the non-compliant sample. So the purposes of the ocean monitoring program are to determine the potential effect of wastewater outfalls on the local coastal environment. The cause of the high exceedances that I express are not as a result of wastewater. And as I pointed out, in terms of the percentages, and yes, that was a kind of a broader statement in terms of the all of the samples that we collect in terms of relatively how many are within compliance. But as you kind of narrow it down, you see that the non-compliant samples are those around the Tijuana River, Los Buenos Creek. And so it helps us to kind of hone in on the potential cause of those elevations. And based on all of the assessment that we've done, we can state very clearly that it's not as a result of the wastewater.
All right. So again, I'm going to put something forward. So during a storm event, and during rain and runoff, you do have high levels on shore locations. You can determine, or you have determined, I should say, you have determined those are not coming from the outfall back on shore. Those are from other locations.
Correct, yes. And this is where we really benefit from the satellite imagery. Satellite imagery has been very useful in during these rain events. You can quite literally see the plume coming from the Tijuana River, and we can connect that up with our data collection, and you can see very clearly where the high fecal indicator bacteria levels are within that plume that's coming from the Tijuana River, as opposed to the plume that's coming from, in that case, the South Bay ocean outfall.
All right. I had difficulty seeing that from the data presented. That's where I'll end my comments. Thank you.
Yeah. No problem. And certainly just in line with previous comments, these are the kind of things we can certainly provide more information to you directly, but also in future presentations, we can focus a little bit more on that to kind of really define and refine how that is worked out.
Could I ask one more question? You have data, plume data from satellite images for every day of storms. Is that correct?
More than likely, yes. We use a third party, a company called Ocean Imaging, who collects the satellite images for us. And so they collect satellite images on a regular basis, and they try and target particular events. So large storm events, they'll try and get satellite images for us for those. But it's not a guarantee for like every single day or on a particular cycle. It's kind of when the satellites are in the appropriate place, as long as there's no cloud cover. There's kind of various factors that go into what's available and when it's available.
So in your report, it matches the satellite data with your other, with the other data that allows you to determine. Can I get find out where that is in the report?
Yeah, I didn't.
I found like I had to look at one set of data and go back to the other. That's all I'm saying.
And if it exists
someplace that's overlapping, I would like the ability to look at it. And that, I thank you.
No, I can appreciate that. It's a lot of information. There is a little bit of page flipping to try and kind of connect some of those things. And just in relation to the satellite imaging, because this is done by a third party, they actually produce an entirely separate report on the satellite images themselves. Historically, we have just taken some of that information and put it in our biannual report for reference so that we can kind of have these conversations about talking about how they overlap. But going forward, we have talked to board members about that report being actually part of our annual report, so it's directly available and not kind of somewhere else.
I'm going to say thank you because I have to excuse myself for just a moment, please. So,
Board Chair
Cantu. Mr. Mitchell.
Yes, there are no speakers at this time from the public.
Okay, thank you. I think this concludes our information item. Dr. Kempster, you can be assured, as you can see from our questions, that we are acutely interested in the health of the ocean in near shore and further from the near shore. San Diego is one of the very few ocean outfalls left. So it's something that draws a lot of scrutiny statewide and western wide. So we're very interested in this presentation. So thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, no problem. May I just add one comment that my team just reminded me of? I think it would be of interest. Just in relation to the outreach and working with school groups. So my team just reminded me, we do actually have an annual open house, of course, with COVID in mind. That's been put on hold for the time being. But we do have an annual open house, which is specifically targeted at families, kids, bring them into, we literally show them all the equipment, we show them data, we show them animals we work with, go through the whole thing. And also, we have been working closely with the Birch Aquarium on some educational outreach that they've been doing. But again, it's been put on hold with COVID, but we certainly hope to jump back into that as soon as we can. But if the board has any recommendations or you'd like to see us do more of that stuff, it's something that our team is very interested in and very engaged with, so we're always open to suggestions.
Thank you. So this concludes the business of our public portion of our meeting. We do have a short closed session where we're going to finalize our annual responsibility for personnel evaluation, which will be conducted in the Teams meeting link. So why don't we take a few minute break and meet at 11:05 on Teams. Thank you very much.
Chair Cantu, if I just may clarify for the public, that the board will be meeting in closed session to discuss item number 11 on the agenda, where the board will consider the appointment, employment, evaluation of performance, or dismissal of a public employee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Board Chair can.
So pardon
the interruption, but I do see that we do have a member of the public who has raised their hand. I'm not sure what it's in regards to, but is the would the board like to hear from this individual or go ahead and move into closed session?
If it is relative to the ocean outfall information item, we'll hear them. If it's relative to something else, we finished our public forum.
Okay. Eric, apologize for mispronouncing your last name.
No worries. My question was pertaining to an agenda item that you hadn't covered at this time, and I wasn't sure if that was in the non-public portion.
Which item is it, please?
There were the items for Danny and Tina Luz and the Campbell family on the agenda regarding the Monteverde culvert.
Chair, to I can respond to that. Those Please. Are items that are listed as part of the closed session. However, the board is not meeting to discuss those items today, and so are not part of this agenda or are not part of today's discussion.
I'm sorry. It was listed on your public website as on the agenda.
We list a number of items on our closed session, but we don't always discuss them at every meeting. I can follow up with the speaker separately to address his concerns.
Okay. Our concerns are substantial, and I would hope you consider it. Thank you for your time.
Good. Mr. Vu will follow up with you. Thank you very much. So we'll recess until we meet in closed session, and there'll be an announcement after closed session regarding any items we have taken back to this site. Thank you very much. We'll see you at 11:05. Dave, Stephanie. Okay, there we go. We're back from closed session, and we're reporting that we took no actions. Thank you very much. We'll see you next month. Goodbye.